And now, for the thousands in attendance and the millions of people that wish they were sitting in front of my bar at the moment, welcome to the 11th episode of At the Bar with Yo Adrian, where I explore the lives and times of some really interesting people. And one of those interesting people happens to be sitting at my bar at the moment, and it's a good morning to Mr. David Birchall. Good morning, David.
Good morning. How are you, Adrian? Pleasure to be here. Thank you very much.
Mate, it's a pleasure to have you, sir, and I'm going to offer you a drink. It's customary here. And you don't have to drink alcohol. I just want to let everyone know that, because a lot of the times I've had people here, they go, have I got to drink an alcoholic beverage? You don't have to. Most of my guests don't drink alcohol. They don't take that option. You're taking the Coca-Cola option.
Yeah.
Diet Coke. I'm actually going to take the alcoholic option. And it's a bottle of Jameson. It's an Irish whiskey. And this is going to be a special drink for me, because I'm going to raise a toast to a beautiful lady that passed away not long ago, and I was at a funeral yesterday. Name's Joslyn Earl. See there. She's a very, very proud Irish lady. Was born in New Zealand. So, Joslyn, this is for you. Okay, let's get into exploring the life and times of D. Birchall. Now, where did you grow up and what did you want to do as a kid?
Well, I grew up in a few different places. Mum and Dad were managing hotels back in the day, so they were managing one out at Redfern. Yeah, so Mum and Dad were managing hotels. The first one was the Thurles Castle at Redfern. So grew up there for a few years, and then they moved on to the Concord Hotel at Concord West.
Yep.
The thing was, they'd bought a place at Sylvania years beforehand. So I went to school. I did my first couple of years at Blackfriars Primary at Redfern, but then went to Sylvania. Like, Mum and Dad, Mum in particular, being a school teacher herself, thought it was better for me to go to school down there, and then we ended up living in Sylvania for a while.
Now, how did you get into boxing?
I've grown up around it. My father, my grandfather's brothers and cousins, all that kind of stuff fought. So I was always around boxing. So it was just a natural thing to do, especially Dad would take me down to Redfern PCYC and to go and watch Uncle Tony Mundine spar all the time. Like, he was like Superman when I was a kid. You know, I'd go down and watch him, and that's what I wanted to be, someone like him.
The reason why I got straight in with the boxing part of it, for those people that don't know, David Birchall was an accomplished Australian boxer, amateur boxer, turned professional. He also then went on to coach and train some of our best boxers, and one of them was Danny Green. And then later on in life, he became a mental health worker, and it's mainly with all sorts of people, or
Primarily in the Aboriginal community, but also just with anyone more within the lower socioeconomic groups, and that people that have fallen through the cracks in our society. Well, they're out there. I worked for New South Wales Health, and I was in an identified role within the Aboriginal community, but obviously when you're going out to see those people that you're supposed to be your clients, you're meeting other people that are in the same situation, facing the same problems, and need the same kind of help. So it's important, you know. It's I'm not going to say to someone, "Oh, you're not Aboriginal or this or that." Yeah. I'm not going to help you. I'm going to help someone, you know, and that's what we should do. And everyone's part of our community, so it's so important to do that. We all have the same struggles, and if you can help the other people within that community, it's going to also help the other people that are there. Like, obviously, the Aboriginal people that were in the housing estates and stuff where I was working at.
And we'll touch on that again later on. Because he knows quite a lot about mental health, and I've learned a lot from him in the time that I've known him, and he knows quite a bit, trust me. So we'll get back into the boxing part of it. So you trained at Redfern, and was that the gym that was next to Redfern Oval, the PCYC?
Yeah, I'd go down to PCYC when I was a kid. Frank Gidley was down there at the time.
That's right, he was my trainer.
Yeah, well, my dad fought Frank.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he was training him. But then Later on, I was training, obviously, with my dad at home, and I was playing football and stuff like that. But then I started training with Manny Hinton down at Glebe State Gym, where Johnny McColl had his gym. You have guys like Uncle Wally Carr and all that training there. But I used to train with Jeff Harding there. So that's where I really learnt my boxing and, yeah, how to be a man as well.
Did you have any did you ever train at Newtown Police Boys?
Yes, I used to train with Johnny. After Manny retired, I was training with Johnny Lewis over at Newtown PCYC, which is great. Like, Johnny's a fantastic human being. I only bumped into him the other day down at Cronulla. He's just a good man. Him and my dad grew up together. Dad's a couple of years older, but, yeah, he and Johnny have been good mates ever since they were kids. And
you'd have to be one of the nicest blokes I've ever met. I mean, anyone that's got anything bad to say about Johnny Lewis, you know, they'd have to be from a different planet.
Yeah. Well,
he's the nicest bloke you'd ever meet.
Beautiful man. He's always been great for me and my family. He's always been there through the ups and downs, and there's been plenty of both. And, yeah, Johnny's always been there, being very supportive all the time. He's the kind of guy you can just come to for advice whenever you need it, life advice, you know, not just about boxing and stuff like that, but, yeah. You know, anything to do with life in general, he's always got an ear to help, like, to listen, and then he'll come up with some good advice, not just, you know, telling you what you want to hear. He'll be brutally honest sometimes. Like, you know, he's told me to put my head in a couple of times, and, yeah, I have. So
as an amateur boxer, I want you to – we'll go back a bit. The first time you walked in to learn boxing, right? So you started off as an amateur boxer like all the boxers – do?
I honestly can't remember when I first started. I was that young. I was boxing.
You would have been around about 13, 14?
Oh, that's when I started probably fighting, but I was boxing like from 5 years old, you know. Dad would take me down there. Gloves would be bigger than us. When we'd go to Johnny McColl's gym, he'd put on exhibition days and stuff, and he'd get a couple of kids, say, oh, you look about the same size. Yeah, you guys can get in, punch on. Yeah. She was always doing that as a kid, but, yeah, once – I hit 14, you start fighting, and, you know, it was great. I loved the rush of it all. Well, I was always playing rugby and stuff too. Like, I loved my boxing. Yeah.
All right. Why don't you give me your favourite memory as an amateur boxer? Think about all the places you would have fought at, St. George Sailing Club and whatever.
Yeah, well, my favourite memory was winning an Australian title at home at Cronulla Leagues Club. In front of, like, all my family, friends, my dad's there, everyone's there. And it was a tough fight. I fought a really good fighter in Stephen Marks. And in the semi-final the night beforehand, I'd fractured my cheekbone, an accidental head clash in the first round of that fight in the semi-final against a guy from Western Australia, Justin Footit. I was boxing against him. My eye swelled shut, and it hurt. Like, it kills. Like, my cheekbone was broken. I end up dropping him in the third round, winning the fight. Then to even make weight the next day was a killer because I couldn't do anything, you know. I sweated it out, just made weight. But getting through the medical and everything, I was lucky Lou Lewis was the doctor. He has air, let him through.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then that fight, I just had to box. Like, I had to make sure, like, Stephen Marks is a very, very tough, hard man. You know, we'd been roommates together in an Australian team the previous year. I knew him well. I knew what kind of fighter he was, and I knew he was going to bring it. You know, I felt like coming at him, but I couldn't because there's no way he would have stopped me if I got hit too early. But in the third round, I traded with him a few times. I got hit a couple of times, luckily not clean, but, yeah, I knew that, yeah, my cheekbone was broken. But to do that under such adversity was a great feeling, you know, really good. Like, aside from that, winning the President's Cup in Jakarta against the number one Russian. That was, you know.
Did you ever get to go to the Olympics? Or were you?
No, I missed out on the Olympics. I was an Olympic alternate. It was very controversial at the time, but it wasn't anything to do with the fighter. It's the politics of sport, you know.
There's a lot of politics in boxing.
Hey, that's life. And it's, it's hard at the time and hard to, you know, take, you think, oh, I deserve this spot and all this kind of stuff. Later on, you just realise it was something that helped make me into the man I am, you know, having those little adversities. It would have been great to go, but it just wasn't meant to be.
So then you turn pro because, as we touched on it, there is a lot of controversy in amateur boxing. You can get dudded at times with decisions and things like that. With professional boxing, you can take it out of the judges' hands a lot of times, and you can...
You can, but even if you do get ripped off, at least you get paid. That's the main thing. Yeah, I went to turn pro, but before I got to turn pro, I was involved in a car accident. And
that's the first... When I first met you, actually, it was during one of your lectures when we were going for that the boxing coaching course. You mentioned that.
Yeah.
And we're all ears and... Yeah,
well, that was the thing.
Tell everyone about it.
Yeah, I was preparing to make a pro debut in 6 to 8 weeks, and you know, I was 10 foot tall and bulletproof. And I used to work at the Tattersalls Club in the city. Mm. That I was riding into work. I used to ride into work in the mornings from Sylvania at the time. You know, because as part of my fitness regime. And one morning, about 4 to 5 in the morning, a guy fell asleep driving the other way, hit me head on about 100 k's. And I can't remember too much about it, except for I felt like whether it was a dream or whatever. I knew there was people around me, but obviously I wasn't conscious because of the way they were talking. I could hear them.
So was your motorbike stationary?
I was a push bike. I was riding a push bike into work. You know, that's was part as part of my training. You know, it's part of my training regime to ride in. You know. As I said, the guy fell asleep driving the other way, and it hit me badly. It ended up, I had to have knee reconstructed. The other knee's got no cartilage. I broke all my ribs on this side, crushed my shoulder, and broke 6 vertebrae in my back. So, yeah, and that's, yeah, been very painful ever since. But I was lucky I got through it. And as I said, I was 10 foot tall and bulletproof 1 minute. Next minute, I couldn't even wipe my own ass.
Was that the end of your professional boxing career? Because you had about 4 or 5 pro fights.
Well, the thing was, I didn't stay in hospital too long. My mum made a ward at home so I could actually recover at home. And that my mum did everything, you know, as mothers do. Yeah. And, yeah, said she had to wipe my ass. I couldn't. And it was very, very humbling. You know, as I said, like, I've gone 10 foot tall and bulletproof. I'm ready to make my pro debut. And then suddenly... Yeah, I couldn't do anything. I couldn't walk, couldn't do anything like that for a while. And, yeah, it's the thing that really motivated me was that they told me, you're not going to do anything again. You're not going to work. You're never going to box again. You're never going to do this. And it's like, you know, I'm going to do it because I have to for my own headspace.
Yep.
And it took me 18 months to leave and jog again. You know, a lot of recovery, working every day, jumping in a pool, and that just to be able to have some movement, and that because I couldn't walk properly at first, you know, and then slowly but surely got fitter, got healthier, and just determination. But it always hurt. My back will always hurt. I know that. It's part of life.
You did get back into a butt.
I got back in. It was a bit over 2 years. I made my pro debut, and like I've got to thank Jeff Fenwick for that. He was a big part of it. He helped me out with it a lot because. I was also helping Jeff as part of Team Fennec as a coach.
I can imagine Jeff. I've met him a couple of times, and I don't know whether he'd ever remember me. He should. We've both got Portuguese heritage. But in saying that, with Jeff, I'm of the belief of Jeff, if he likes you, he'd do anything for you. He'd be a really loyal guy.
He is, you know. I've known Jeff a long time, ever since I was a kid, and... Obviously, you're idolising when you're growing up as a, like he's one of your heroes growing up. He's a four-time world champion.
Best boxer ever to come out of Australia.
Definitely Australia's greatest boxer.
Greatest ever.
Four-time world champion. Who's going to get better than that? And, Jeff's the kind of guy, we've had ups and downs in our relationships as well, but everything's... You know, everything's come through at the end. Like, you know, at the end of the day, he's a loyal, good man. You know, you can have disagreements at times, but, you know, Jeff's got a lot of love and respect for Jeff. And as I said, he helped me a lot during that time to motivate you because, he did care, he didn't give a fuck when you're in the gym. You've got to train hard. You've got to put in the hard yards. You're not going to get an easy way out with things. And, it helped motivate me with it. Also, I learned so much from him.
Jeff had incredible stamina, and I'm sure that he would have instilled that in a lot of his boxers. I mean, Jeff Harding was really, really fit.
Both of them. Like, that, the way their work ethic with their training was just phenomenal. They were freaks. And if you've got a sports scientist in, they tell you this is the wrong way to train, you know, because you've got to have more recovery, this, that. They just, you know, train hard. But that instilled a work ethic in us as young men, but also it made you hard. You had to be hard. You had to be hard. To be able to survive, even in the gym. You know, for me as an amateur, even when I was training, like I'd have days, I'd have weeks where I might spar Troy Waters one day, then spar Kosh Azu, Justin Roussel, all these guys within a week. Like, and these are all phenomenal fighters. And unless I brought my A game, you're going to get pumped. Simple as that. They came for they came to like bust you up sometimes. Like,
who was your trainer?
Manny Hinton.
And Manny, now he was a hardcore sort of guy. I met him once.
Yeah,
and he was like he had this sort of Jack Gibson aura about him.
Well, he and Jack were really good mates, and I was lucky enough to meet Jack a few times through Manny, and yeah, they were very, very similar types. With Manny, back when he was training Jeff Harding, Jeff might have had a few issues. Sometimes he'd go out to get on the drink before a fight, and you get a call up from Manny at might be 2 a.m. Dave will come to pick you up.
Yeah.
That Jeff's in a bit of trouble. Go get Jeff from a bar or whatever. End up punching on with the bouncers, and that Manny would take out most of them, even though I'm like 18-year-old boy. He's like in his 60s and he could fight, mate.
He was 60s, he's a hard, young guy.
He's a hard man. Yeah. And that, I would hate to see him on the cobbles back in the day. But
reminds me of my old man.
Yeah, he's a hard man and just, he was a great man to like be around. But he was also that same thing. They bring up the tough love, but they also teach you how to become a man as well. You know, Manny has been like a father figure to me, and that, like, I was lucky. I've got a great father, but, you know, most boys, we don't listen to our dads at times. So I was very lucky to have another man in my life that was able to instill good values and stuff like that and bring me up the right way. And Manny was that man.
So you got to about, how many professional fights did you end up having?
I had the 4 professional fights, but I knew, after like the second one as well, like it wasn't going to last too long. Just the strain on my body from the training. It was just.
Did that have anything to do with that accident that you had?
Yeah, that was the thing. Like, I knew like I could do 4 to 6 rounds like I used to be able to. I couldn't do 12 rounds like that. You know, it would have, and just the training you have to do to get yourself fit enough to be able to do a 12 round fight is just phenomenal. And like every day waking up in pain and feel like crying, like that's the thing, you had to suck it up and be there at training. But there's many days where I'd wake up and just want to just pull the doona back out of my head and cry. Because
in all honesty, look back at that now, your boxing, do you believe, and you can say I would have been a champion, a world champion. Do you reckon you had the ability to go all the way and win not only regional titles but a world title down the track?
Yeah, lots of people have the ability. It's not just about having the ability, it's having the luck. And things fall into place. And it wasn't meant to be for me. Okay, I had that car accident. And I don't have any regrets at all because I did the most I could do with the time I had. And to say, I could have been this, could have been that, I find that's a negative thing. Like, I had ability, but, you know, it just wasn't meant to be. And it's made me a better trainer. It's made me a better coach because I realised, boom, everything can change like that. And it's so important to make the most of the time you have. As I said, I'm happy with everything I did. I did what I could during the time I had but it got taken away from me at a certain time. And that's what can happen in life. You know, things can be taken away from you. So it's very important. That's why I tell the fighters I train, like, you know, if you want to be a fighter, do it properly. If you want to go and party, go party properly. You know, if that's what you want to do, you know.
Can't
do both, you know. Don't have regrets by not putting in everything you wanted to, like, all your effort into something when you say you want to do it.
It's a perfect segue. You're talking about straight into training. You were saying that I may be a better trainer. Now, in your capacity as a trainer, who have you shared the corner, or who have you shared the corner with?
Been blessed. You know, all of Team Fenny back in the day, the same brothers, like Hussey and Skinny, and they've been like brothers to me, Nader Hamden, just everyone with Team Fennec back in that day. Ian McLeod, he was a good man from up Tully in North Queensland.
You mentioned Nader, so I know he's a friend of mine on Facebook, so we'll...
Yeah, definitely. Nader's a great man. And then, yeah, Sakya Beaker, Danny Green, been there with Chalk, everyone, you know, and so many other fighters. Sorry if I've forgotten to mention you, but yeah, everyone, even like guys that have been there for one amateur fight, have helped me along my journey as well to learn to appreciate things, because sometimes you get more reward out of seeing that person that comes in and, you know, they might have all the ability in the world, they just want to have that one amateur fight. And that's what, you know, just watch them go through and progress is a great thing.
Your main guy was probably Danny Green.
Yeah, Daniel.
How did you? I've always thought of this. How did you cope? Because you're pretty close. You're related to Anthony Mundy.
Yeah, no, close to him. Not related, but yeah,
You're very close to him. How did he find it when you?
Well, cool. Like as I said,
his nemesis.
Yeah, I used to send my boys over to spar with Anthony when I'm training Chalk. Also, when I'm training Greeny. Yeah. You know, I'd send my boys down to spar with him. I didn't want to know what's going on, like, you know, because that was going to help my boys that were sparring him and that to progress in their careers. And that obviously I didn't go down there at the time when they were sparring. But yeah, we're always cool. Like, you know, before, after, everything, you know, there's a bit of banter every now and then. But like when the second fight got announced, like Greeny's rung me up, Birch put the band back together, and they'd come down to Melbourne for the training camp. First person I went to see was Annie Lynn, Chock's mum. Let her know it's all and everything's cool. Before the fight, I was the one that went in to make sure like the hands get wrapped properly and, you know, put the gloves on properly, but also brought in ice creams for his kids and his nephews and stuff like that. You know, there's no animosity. I love Uncle Tony. He's one of my idols.
I'll second that. Lovely guy.
Yeah, beautiful man. Hey, it's only business once they're in that ring. You know, there's, you know, and you've got to have that respect for your opponents. Like all the banter and the crap that they talk, they don't believe any of that. They both respect each other. They know that the other guy's a good fighter and he's going to bring his best. And he's out there to hurt you and can hurt you.
We're both. I mean, I think Danny Green won 4 world championships at 3 different weight divisions. And I think Chock did something similar.
Very similar. Like, they're two, like, Chock's the greatest athlete, you know, that I've ever seen. Anything. Football, like
rugby league.
You know, fantastic boxer. Different styles of fighting. They're both two of our greatest boxers of all time, and that should be appreciated, you know. That, and they brought the sport alive. You know, the two biggest fights in Australian history are Mundy and Green 1 and 2.
Now, I want you to be objective here, mate.
Yep.
Out of the two times that they fought,
yep,
who do you think got the better?
Obviously, Chock won that first one.
Yep.
You know,
that was,
you know, there's...
Heroes.
Yeah, no dispute there. The second fight, I do believe Daniel won it, you know, and it was the referee's fault that happened, that incident happened where with that shot that Anthony hit Daniel with. But Daniel was gone after that. He was for a few rounds. Like, I'm so glad we went back to basics. He went back to his jab all the time because in between rounds, like, Daniel wasn't with it for the, like, 4 or 5 rounds after. If Chock had jumped on him at the time and known to jump on him, it could have been a different fight, but like Daniel is so tough and resilient, and he soldiered on through it. You know, I believe that Daniel won that second fight. It was a good close fight, but you know, they're both not in the peak of their prime of their careers, but they're both at a very good stage, and they, you know, they put up a good fight. It was a good hard fight. I believe Daniel won that second fight. Obviously, the first one, Chock won.
I spoke to, as you remember, Anthony was at your gym
a
couple of weeks ago. And back then I told him, I said, listen, I said, you won the first and you won the second, so I've got to respectfully disagree with you.
Yeah, that's fine.
It's a matter of opinion. I just thought different styles make different fights, and Anthony always had Danny's measure. That's not saying that Danny's a great, he's a great fighter. He beat Roy Jones Jr.
And
one round.
That's the thing, yeah.
Great. Wow.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. But, yeah, I just always found that Chock had his measure. And Anthony, I find Anthony doesn't get the recognition that he deserves.
He's
a lot of people go, he was just well managed. Well,
he was well managed, but he fought some very good fighters. You know, to beat Antoine Eccles like he did to win that first world title, and that was a big fight. You know, Antoine could fight, but also he fought Sven Otke, and that he was only a novice. Like Sven was like one of the most accomplished amateur boxers in German history. He was an undefeated professional and, you know, continued to be an undefeated professional throughout his career. He was technically very good. Like, Chock was only a novice at that stage. He had no right even being a sparring partner for Sven Otke, like, on paper. But, you know, to put up such a great fight and being ahead on the cards and coming this close to winning the world title so new in his career as a boxer, you know. He's fights with Mikel Kessler. That was a good fight, you know.
Who was that other American guy that he fought? He's a black American guy.
And he doesn't really narrow it down.
I think he pulled his arm during the fight and then it had to get stopped. You remember him?
Probably do if you tell me the name, but yeah.
He was right up there, this guy. They reckon one of the best welterweights to come out of America.
Mosley.
Yeah, Shane
Mosley.
Yeah.
That's
the one.
Yeah,
you pick it up.
Yeah, yeah.
Mosley. Beat him.
Yeah, exactly. That's the thing. Like, Chuck's been some great fighters. He's been in there with the best. Even when he's lost, you know, he's made you have to earn it. And he's tested himself the whole time. It's not like he ducked anyone. Like, neither of them have ducked anyone. They've fought the best, you know. And they've fallen short at times. But it's only because they're out there putting themselves out there to have a go. And that's what you got to respect in sport. Guys like Floyd Mayweather, yes, he's a great fighter and all that kind of stuff, but he didn't always fight guys in their prime. He didn't fight the best that he could have at times. He fought the guys that made him the most money.
That argument's always going to be around. Like, one of my great idols is Rocky Marciano, when people say, during 52 to 56, there was no great heavyweights. We can only beat who's put in front of you at the time. They said he was too small, 5'10". And, I have this argument with my boys all the time. They go, he's too small, Dad.
Hey,
nothing to do with height, you know. I mean, Tyson was only 5'10½".
He'd find a way. He has this.
Yeah.
And as I said, you can only fight the people that are there at the time. Like, I love Joe Lewis. You know, he's fantastic. For 11 years.
11 years, yeah. 20 world defences.
Yeah,
know?
He's like...
to be up in the top three.
Exactly, but they're only going to be the best for their time, like the Jack Dempsey's, Jack Johnson's, people like that. Always loved Harry Greb, like famous middleweight from back in the day. And that, like, he'd go fight you 15 rounds in the ring, then he'd go find you in a bar afterwards and punch on with you there. He did that with Mickey Walker.
He had the roughest head I've ever seen.
Exactly.
He had over about 200 and something fights.
Close to 400 fights.
Like heaps. And he was...
But he didn't train.
To fight him.
Yeah, even heavyweights, you know. Jack Dempsey didn't want to fight him. He beat Gene Tunney, the only man that beat Jack Dempsey. He'd beaten him in a fight.
That's right.
You know, but he fought...
Gene Tunney, I think, beat Dempsey twice too.
Yes, yeah. But the thing is, like, when we talked about Floyd Mayweather before, 50-0, right, over however many years he fought, and that Harry Greb was 52-0 over a year and 4 months at one stage of his career. You know, and fought a number of world champions. Like, this is how often he fought, and this is the difference in the eras. You know, you can only be the best for your time. And if you are the best for your time, fantastic, you know, and good on you. You can only, as I said, you only fight the guys you can fight. It's like comparing, say, okay, Penrith today in the rugby league compared to the St. George team of the 50s and 60s or the Parramatta team of the early 80s. Like, they're all freaks of their time. You know, and they can only be the best. Like, and there's arguments to be made for it, but they're the best of their time.
Say the same thing about tennis and lots of things. I know with runners that people now, they run faster than what they did 30, 40 years ago. With boxing, I believe that the fighters were much tougher back in those days because, you know, I mean, poverty.
You had to be tough.
You had to be tough. You know what I mean?
Different mindset. It's a different mindset. But you still got guys that will come from Mexico or whatever that have grown up in a cardboard shanty or grown up on the streets. Or say someone like Pacquiao, who grew up as a kid on the streets and stuff, very poor and hungry. They've got a different mindset to a kid that's grown up in the eastern suburbs of Sydney, you know, got everything given to them or whatever. They've got a different mindset. You know, it's
And in boxing also, there was like golden eras. I found that, because I was old enough to remember, golden era for boxing for me was the late 70s, early 80s, when we had like the heavyweight division. You had fighters like Ali, you had Spinks.
You got Frazier, you've got Joe Foreman, Frazier. You've got Larry Holmes.
Larry Holmes is my
Kenny
Norton.
Right, yeah. No. But you've also got the Ernie Shavers.
Ron Lyle. There's so many good fighters. And then there was this lull period where it got a bit boring. You had guys like Greg Page and the heavyweight.
They were really good fighters. They were good fighters, but they're not the same. They haven't got the same charisma and stuff as the Ali's and stuff like that had. And also a lot of them had drug problems. Unfortunately, they came along during the crack era of American society.
Early 80s.
American society, and that filtered through, obviously, to all aspects of life. And guys like that did have issues outside the ring, you know, which is very, very sad. But, you know, unfortunately, it's a part of life. Like Pinklin Thomas, as you said, Greg Page, very, very talented fighters, but never achieved their best due to... outside aspects and that, you know, they never achieved the best. But then you had guys, when the heavyweights weren't doing so well, you had the Ray Leonards, the Marvin Hagler. My idol, Tommy Hearns. Manos de Piedra, Roberto Duran.
How many good middleweights were there?
Yeah, Wilfred
Agabi the Beast, who fought another friend of ours, Glenn Kelly. Glenn caught him, beat him as he was aging at the time. Yeah, Agabi, you still beat him, still got him as a victory.
Just to be in the same ring as Mugabe is a big thing, you know. But yeah, they had great fighters throughout it. And that's the thing, you only get judged off the opponents you can have. And when you're in a good era like that, in a strong era, that's where you'll be remembered. Like Golovkin is another all-time great. When you've got Cotto's, Canelo, guys like that, this era of fighters, they're great fighters. And they'd handle. So that's the thing.
And then remember when Tyson came in 1980, I'll never forget, it was 86, I would have been probably 16, year 10. This guy walks in with no socks. The music was just noise. Boom, boom, boom. And he walks in and he just absolutely destroyed Trevor Burbick to win the heavyweight title. And I remember the commentator saying, "We have a new era in boxing."
Yeah.
And he was so right. It was unbelievable. I'd never seen anything like it.
I was lucky. Charlie Gergen, still makes me son Chris. Charlie was like great guy.
Adrian Cafe all the time.
Yeah, but he was mates with my dad. Yeah. He used to bring, when he'd go overseas, he'd bring back like videos of fighters. And he brought back some from, I remember the Olympic trials, even back in 84. And I'd seen Tyson fight there. He got beat, but... he got beat by Henry Tillman, but he said, this is the guy to kind of watch out for. And I saw some of his earlier fights. Sammy Scaff or something like that. He knocked out this big guy, busted his nose up everywhere. And then they showed a couple of his fights on Wild Border Sports back in the day. They'd have it on a Saturday. Like, they knew that Tyson was going to be something. So I knew that he was going to beat Burbick that day, you know, because I'd been lucky enough to have seen bits of him as an amateur, but then... Also, in the early career, they went along right.
I followed him. I used to get the Ring magazine, and I looked at this guy, and he looked like he was a throwback from the 50s and 60s. He had this mean-looking head. And it's an irony that Charlie Gergen, you mentioned, because he was the most disqualified Australian boxer. He was.
Yeah.
We all know what happened to Tyson. It was that was the most famous disqualification with the ear bite years later. But, yeah, Tyson... Back in his day was unbelievable, but I believe Mike Tyson peaked early.
Yeah, mate, his whole life was done fast.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? He was, I unfortunately, from obviously his childhood and that, the things he went through, you grow up fast.
Yeah.
You know, you put in a detention center as a young boy and stuff. And then to suddenly get all this stuff and become such a great fighter. But as Marvin Hagler said, it's very hard waking up at 5 a.m. to go do your road work and you're waking up in silk pajamas.
That's right.
Tyson suddenly made all this money. Here's a guy that's had nothing. And, you know, suddenly you've been thrown all this money and you've got all these hangers on telling you this, this, this. I can do this for you. I'm your brother. I'm this and that. And, you know, unfortunately didn't have probably real people in his life that were there that he could trust and that to manage him properly and things like that, you know.
You got that with it, Kevin Rooney. I thought when he had Kevin Rooney was his trainer.
Yeah.
He made a massive difference.
Yeah, but then you got Yes Men after that. You know, I know Jeff's very good mates with him. I was lucky enough to meet him a few times with Jeff, you know, and to us, he was great. And you could tell, but too, like he had that respect for Jeff. And we just treated him like one of the boys. We trained at the same gym and, you know, we even went back to his house one time after the franchise both away in and got us all pizzas and stuff like that.
Sam, what was he like back? I mean, he comes across now as a mild bloke. He's like, since then, he smoked a lot of gunge and had his DMT and all that sort of stuff.
Back
then, was he like really...
You could say he was intense. He was intense.
Yeah.
I remember we were there that day after the weigh-in. We're there. He said, got us pizzas. We're having a laugh with him. Paying him out about he got ferrets because he'd got rid of his lion and tiger. Or he got rid of his tigers because of some council thing. We're taking the mickey out of him about it. He ended up grabbing me on the top of the head and like, up like with one hand because I was paying him out saying, oh, you go to him because you're scared. He's going, oh, bullshit, I used to wrestle him like this. I'm like, wow, just laughing at him. And then he just thought, you guys are fucked up because what are you laughing for? But, you know, I was thinking, like, shit, I'm going to get killed by Mike Tyson. How good's this? But, yeah, he was really good with us. And then suddenly he was getting interviewed by Matthew Brooks for Sky Channel. And Matt asked him the basic question, or I can't remember the question he asked him, and he turned. Like, he just clicked, like, boom, like, that Mike Tyson ready to kill you. And then lucky Jeff was there, like, calmed him down a bit. And, yeah, but I remember that day he got a brand new Ducati. He didn't even have the stickers on it. And then he's gone off riding it about 300 k's down the road. Like,
he had a genuine affection with Jeff.
Oh, yeah, 100%. Like, how could you not admire Jeff as a fighter that back in the day, like,
Duran,
yeah, Roberto Duran and Jeff, they even looked similar, you know, with the Bow and Goatee and stuff, the similar styles. And yeah, you couldn't, as a boxing purist, like, genuine, like, that loves fighting, you couldn't not like someone like Jeff Fenwick in his prime, you know. And obviously, him and Tyson being a boxing enthusiast and historian as well as a great athlete himself. Now, of course, he's going to look at someone like Jeff and think, wow.
Like, it's funny, when he, I remember he lost the fight to Usama Nelson.
You remember the draw? No, when he got beat, yeah.
I followed Jeff Fenwick like we all did, and I wouldn't say he was a hero, but I admired him. But then I remember I was at Balmain Leagues Club, and he lost the fight. And I remember all these guys all starting to carry on going, oh, he's not even an Aussie anyway. He's an effing wog. And I got the shits.
Yeah, well, that's what? Typical tall poppy syndrome.
And I, like, he probably doesn't even know this, Jeff, but I got in a stink over him. You know, yeah. I got thrown out of a place because I went up to a bloke and said, what'd you say? I hated that word wog.
Yeah.
And then I thought to myself, well, you know, we've got the same, I'm born here, he's born here.
Yeah.
You know? And then I just took offence to it and he got thrown out of the place. And it was because of supporting Jeff Fenwick. I just got the shits over it.
I've been in more punch-ups over guys like Jeff, Greeny or Chalk. Like, especially if you go to the pub or whatever and watch Chalk when he fought, because, yeah, he was controversial. And, like, people would say something about it. It's like, mate, like, he's my friend.
Yeah.
Like, you know, whatever you might think, like, he's my friend, please don't speak about him like that. But then, of course, they'd go on and, you're not going to cop that. People talking about your friends like that, you know, it just doesn't happen. But, yeah, same thing with Jeff. You know, that's the thing. But none of them would say it to his face, I can guarantee you.
No.
That's one of the things I've learned for myself, you know. I've got my son fighting now, you know, he's the youngest pro in Australia and people want to criticise. Most people are very supportive and, you know, and behind you all the way. But you also know there's those people that even maybe nice to your face that then run shit, talk shit behind your back. And there's other people that openly, you know, be critical and stuff. And it's just learning to, okay, let the haters be, you know, like who are they to speak? You know, most of them have done nothing in their life. They're not game to do anything in their life, you know, and their opinion means nothing to me. I value the opinion of my family and friends. Yep. But other than that, like, you know, I've learned to, like, let that kind of shit go.
We'll touch on Benji later on. We're going to talk a little bit about Benji. And I said, so I hope Benji doesn't, I know he's a humble kid, but and we're not going to put him on the spot, but I'm going to get your dad talking about Benji. Now, what's your advice for a young kid starting out in boxing? You've been a trainer.
Main thing is finding, obviously, for him, like, to find a good trainer. That's the most important thing. And
they're hard to find.
Yeah, they are. Unfortunately, you've got a lot of people that have watched stuff on YouTube or they think they're a coach, whatever. You do have to have that experience and that. And it's like also trainers are going to be honest that, okay, I can help you out at this stage of your career. Being honest enough with people that, okay, son, it's love, whatever, if it's a boy or a girl fighting, girls are very good at the moment, I can tell you that much. Like, you know, female fighting is really good. It's making sure you've got someone that's honest with you, and if things aren't working out here, look, you know, this isn't working with us, try this trainer, that people are going to be honest. You've got to be dedicated, be prepared. It's not a sacrifice, it's a life choice. If you want to be a fighter, you've got to choose to, you know, schedule your training, your diet and everything else. Be prepared to go through fights. Know that your amateur career is just a learning experience. You may have a few losses. Who cares? That's part of life. You're going to screw up. It's only a loss if you don't learn from it. You know, it's the only way it's truly a loss. That you're going to learn, and you'll actually learn more from those defeats in the ring, you know, and it can really inspire you and make you more hungry to get on. But it's finding a good trainer, listening to them, living the right lifestyle is important too. You know, you've got to be able to be dedicated to it. If you can't, don't bother. Do it for fun. Learn how to box.
Doesn't it teach you discipline? You walk into, I've seen kids walk into police boys clubs and, you know, scallywag sort of kids, they've been in trouble and that, and they go in there, they learn discipline, especially in the police, PCYCs, and they learn discipline, and it just changes their whole mindset about things. They were going out, getting trouble, drinking, looking for stinks on the weekend, and then they become disciplined. They have a few fights. They realise also that they're not invincible and that they get touched up in a spa.
You get humbled very, very easily.
Very quickly.
You come in thinking, yeah, Billy Big Bollocks, you know. A lot of guys do. They might be buff and all this. You put them with the guy half their size,
exactly.
He touches them up in the ring, and they soon learn. And a lot of them just never come back. A lot of them come back going, look, I want to learn. But the good thing is the boxing, as I said, if you've got a good trainer and you've got it, it's just a good people person around that can manage your manage your boxing, but also help you manage your life as well, and is a good role model. And that's one of the things as a coach, you've got to know that whether you like it or not, kids are going to look up to you. So you've got to try and live that lifestyle yourself, you know, be a good person, be humble and all that. But it's, it does humble you. It teaches you that discipline. And as I said, it's from what the trainer does. And that if you're the kind of guy that's a big mouth and all this kind of shit and wants to run other people down, your fighter's going to end up being the same, you know, and they'll get touched up in the future. Where if you're a humble person and you're prepared to learn from others, like I know I'll never know everything about boxing. I've been doing this all my life, but I'll never know everything about boxing. It's that kind of sport where if, you know, you suddenly think you know everything, someone walks in the gym doing everything wrong, but it works for them, working out their style and stuff like that. But, yeah. It's boxing's at great level, and for a lot of those kids you were talking about, they've come from maybe a dysfunctional family. They've come from a lot of shit. Like boxing, they come into the gym. As I said, that boxing coach, they look at you as, like they admire you for the wrong reasons at first, because they think it's like a play school. It's like a schoolyard, you know. Whoever's the toughest bully, they look up to you. But when they see that you might be the toughest bully, but you're also not a bully. you're actually a good person. There's no point to be that bully, you know. Yeah. You don't have to be like that. You don't have to have that attitude, you know. You can still be a good person and be a good fighter. Now, once they learn that, it changes their outlook on you and it changes their outlook on life as well.
Nader Hamden,
yep.
Friend of ours,
yep.
On Facebook, he was, he was a wild kid.
I remember Nader.
He'd probably admit that.
Look
at him now.
I sparred him very early in his career.
Nader's
one of the most beautiful people I know.
I know. I met him once and at Star City. Again, he probably doesn't remember, but I introduced myself to him. It was a Fennec fight night at the showroom. And I got talking to him on the south door at Star City when I was running the security up there. And, lovely bloke. So humble and...
He is, you know, but obviously, and he'll be the first. I mean, he came in at first, like he's fresh out of juvie, you know, and wanted to be the hardest guy around and stuff. And then, he would have got humbled during his boxing career, as we all do. And that's why he's the kind of man he is today, you know. He's one of the people I'm most proud of. I'd do anything for him. Like, I've seen it from the start. I've seen his career from the start. And I'm so blessed to have been a part of it. Been in his corner for world title fights and that over in Germany. Like, you know, he's one of the most beautiful people I know.
Yeah, no, I certainly believe that, mate. Just things I've seen, like some of the things he posts a lot of stuff where he's helping kids out all the time. Now, let's talk about your own kids.
Yep.
Benji. And what's happening with Benji?
Benji,
15-year-old, youngest professional.
Yep.
Since Lionel Rose, is that correct?
Yeah, Uncle Lionel was 16. Yeah, he beat Uncle Lionel for a year. So that's the thing. I think the only one who may have turned pro in a similar age would be Jeff Malcolm, the Flash. Mm. But you know, turning pro young is he had 25 amateur fights. He fought in both the league and the association, and due to the political nature of things, like I'll say it straight out, like the president of Boxing New South Wales, to me, is an absolute grub. And that took out his own personal thing that he has with me that has nothing to do with boxing, took it out of my son. You know, tried to not register him, even went so far as to tell referees and judges not to vote for him when they did allow him to fight and stuff. It's just pathetic. And Benji got sick of it. One night he... Like, I believe he flogged the kid. I thought he'd won the fight easily. Even Johnny Lewis rang me up afterwards going, Dave, what the bullshit, you know? Like, and for Johnny to do that, you know that it was, you know, it wasn't good. And for Benji, he was losing his love for the sport. He said, Dad, I want to turn pro. I'm not fighting amateur anymore. I want to turn pro. And so he disciplined himself to make sure that, you know, his lifestyle... Inside, outside of training is great. His training, he's very disciplined with his diet, everything else, his school life. And that was one of the most important things. Went and spoke to his deputy principal to organize, structure how we can have him still finish school and that and get like decent grades and get an education as well as, you know, embark on a professional career. And he's really got that.
Yeah, you're big on that because you said earlier on your mum was a school teacher.
Yes.
And I'm not just saying, but. The stereotype is boxers aren't bright. You break that stereotype because you're a very bright guy.
I was just encouraged to read a lot as a child. Yeah. You know? And that's the thing. I wasn't the best at school, I can tell you that much. I didn't like turning up to it, you know. Plus, I was working when I was at school. But it's so important having an education. And since I got out of school, obviously, I've, you know, gone back to learn. But back on Benji, like, you know, he's got that disciplined lifestyle with it. He's had his first professional fight in December over in Thailand, won by first round stoppage. The kid he fought had a dozen or so Muay Thai fights. He'd probably just never been hit like that. Benji hit him early, and that he got over the kid, you know. He's having his second fight on the 28th of February in Bangkok again. Then on the 7th of March, we fight in Patau on Les Sherrington's show. Les is a former Australian champion from up in Queensland. He takes guys over to fight and shows over in Pattaya. We're going to fight in his promotion.
That's two back to fights. So yeah. Hopefully he'll be 3-0. And then down the track, you're looking to, like, once he's over 18, to probably get a fight here in
Obviously, when Australia. He's 18, fight here in Australia. But the thing is, it's about learning. Like, you know, the next few years, get as many professional fights as you can overseas. And the hard work's really done in the gym. And that's where the hard work should be done.
Who's taught him his body punching? He's a great body puncher.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a lot of Australian boxers don't really. I mean, the only one that comes to mind, Skinny Hussain, was a good body puncher.
Skinny's like, other obviously, than that, there hasn't been involved with Skinny. Yeah, been involved with Skinny all my life and that. I've known him since we were kids. Benji's always, you know.
Yeah, well, he's good at it.
Like, he goes down, he went down and sparred at Skinny's gym the other day. We normally go to body punch at La Kemba once a week. Every Wednesday we go there. Normally spar there on the Wednesdays and Sundays we spar at our gym. But, you know, he's always been around the boys. He's always enjoyed it. And, you know, being a Hagler fan myself and that, you know, he always... putting that pressure on, but he also likes Julio Cesar Chavez, another great body puncher, and Roberto Duran. He even named our dog Duran. That's how much he likes him. So, yeah, Benji goes well to the body. He also knows it's the best way to take someone's legs out. You know, if you're going to break people down, take their body, you know. Otherwise, they're too fresh and they want to punch you in the head back. So
what we'll talk about now is we're going to move away from boxing and we're going to talk about mental health, because you involved yourself in mental health. And it's something very, very dear to both of us. We both have someone very, very close in our lives that have suffered with mental health issues. And
I can say for myself, I've suffered from myself. You know, we all go through a lot of things in life, and, yeah, it's how we deal with them. It's so important. So
I was going to ask you, what got you involved in it?
Well, obviously, you've been what's called an incidental counsellor for however long being a boxing coach. Because you always, you know, you got kids in your gym that are going through stuff and you're talking to them about it. So you've always been around that type of thing. And then about 7-8 years ago, I started working at an Aboriginal corporation doing the men's group and stuff like that, and also looking after a lot of our elders. And later on, a role came up with New South Wales Health. It was obviously targeting Aboriginal mental health, drug and alcohol mental health. But as I said before, like, you know, you help everyone in community as much as you can. And that really opened my eyes. I knew a lot about aspects of it, having seen, being, growing up in pubs, obviously you see a lot of alcohol and drugs. Now, one of my uncles was a former addict. You know, so I've seen that all my life and been around it. And you understand that, you know, people, like, hate that word junkie. Like, that someone's, they're an addict with an issue, because that someone loves that person, you know. Like, it's someone's brother, sister, you know, father, mother, whatever, you know. And that's why it's so important to try and help these people. And the reason that these people are medicating themselves is because of the trauma they've suffered in life.
And you don't know what someone's been through in life. You know, you sit there and judge and go, oh, look at this guy. But imagine if you lost a parent at a young age, or
losing your child.
If you're a father and you lost a child, I mean, I'd be a mess.
Yeah, 100%. And
I'd be on everything probably to get through it.
Yeah, you know what I mean? And that's a lot of the people I dealt with. And unfortunately, a lot of these people too, like, they're born behind the eight ball. You know, they were brought into the wrong, bad parents. That I had kids that I worked with that had been sold off since 8 years of age for methamphetamine for their parents and grandparents. You know, by the time they're 14, 15, they're becoming heroin addicts, help them cope with it all. And to help these kids stop being recidivist offenders in the legal system, and also to get them clean and get them away from that environment, is very hard. And, you know, I've dealt with a lot of people that have suffered from sexual abuse as children. So that's why they've formed these habits, or they've, as you said, I've people that have lost family members, they've lost kids. You know, it's really, really hard, you know. And I know from my own personal space, like, having my accident hurt me, you know, mentally, like, every day knowing that I have pain from stuff, you know. But then also working within that environment, you walk in on a lot of things that, you know, traumatise you.
Yeah.
And you also hear a lot of stuff that traumatises you. I got locked up 2018 over a shooting that I had nothing to do with. You know, things like that. Being incarcerated for, you know, suddenly I'm in MRRC for a couple of months, and that over something I had nothing to do with was really hard, especially when I've got a full page in the paper saying that I've done this and this, yeah. and, you know, the effect that has on your kids, then suddenly going through 18 months of continual harassment from the police trying to get me to make a statement on the guys that actually did it, that I didn't even know that until finally the whole case, they admitted their guilt.
Does that still affect you today?
Yeah, it does. Yeah. Like, I have a lot of trauma with police. You know, I did my best when I was working to work in the court system and work alongside the police so that I'd try and lose that resentment. And also so I can teach my kids that, you know, not all police officers are bad people, you know, because we'd be driving along and they'd come around and rip you out of your car, go through everything, take everything out of your car while my kids are in there. You know, I've had them run through my house before. It's not much fun. And you know, it does bring a lot of trauma.
Yeah, you talk about that post-traumatic stress syndrome. I remember being at the police academy many, many years ago, and you're at Goulburn, and then you spend 4 weeks at a police... Sorry, I think that's 1 week. 1 week at a police station. In that 1 week, I remember going to a cot def, and that stuffed me up. And I never forget it. And then years later, I had my own child, and I was that paranoid. I kept on. That was when Joseph was born, my eldest son. And I'm looking all the time, looking in the cot, looking in the cot, looking in the cot. And it got I couldn't sleep at night. And obviously, when you don't sleep, the next day you're stuffed. And yeah, and back then I thought I'm not going to have counselling, anything like that. And I remember getting hypnotised, and it helped a little bit. But it's one of those things in Australia, I notice all over Australia, they don't put enough money into mental health. It's crazy. I mean, someone goes into, you know, goes into psychosis or whatever, they get put in a mental place for about 3 days, and then they're told, okay, they give a medication and they're sent back home again. There's no ongoing psychotherapy. They might give them the medication, but it's just, okay, you'll be right. You're not like years ago. Do you remember you had Callan Park and places like that where you could stay stays? They don't exist anymore.
And that's the unfortunate bit. They throw all this money around and so many other things, and they'll throw it into prisons and stuff like that. But you could stop a lot of that offending by having places like Cullen Park. And this is one of the things that was part of my role. I was working in community. So I'd engage with people while they're in the mental health unit. And then once they got out, I'm the one that's trying to help them adjust back into society. That, which is so hard because this person is struggling to get out of bed or to put socks on, you know, to have a shower or anything, and to get them to have the right medications at the right times, turn up at their hospital appointments and things like that. As I said, most of these people, they fall through the cracks and no one cares. And this is the reason why they end up back in prison, or they end up back in the mental health unit in psychosis, or they end up back as an addict. We're unfortunately hanging from the ceiling because they can't handle it anymore. And this is one of the things, like when we were younger, this was what was used to harden up some, you know, and a lot of men turn to that. I know that I had at times, you know, dealing with what I was dealing with every day, and that it got to the stage where I didn't want to think about things at nighttime. And, you know, because you may have seen something that I couldn't go and talk to my kids about. You know, some of the things I'd see or hear, I can't come home and, like, what did you do at work today? And, you can't talk about that to your kids, you know.
And it can affect anyone. I mean,
it does. It doesn't matter how hard or tough you think you are. Like, it got to a stage where, you know, I dealt with a lot of death at a certain time, and that was really hard. And working with people very close to you as well, like doing parts of palliative care where you're working with people right up until their death and making sure that, you know, they're dressed the way they want to be dressed, like once they've died and things. And it's really hard because you get that attachment to that person, or others where you may have found them dead, and then you've got to go and explain to their family what's happened, and their kids want to come, but sorry, it's a crime scene. You can't even come and see your dad and stuff like that. Like, that's very traumatizing. I don't know how I would have handled seeing a child. Say, like, you had to, but still, like, seeing others and they come back and visit you in your dreams and stuff like that. And that's why people tend to medicate themselves, you know. And I realized with myself, that's why I do my best not to drink anymore. Because it was used as a coping mechanism to handle it. I found better strategies, like with my exercise and, you know, breaking things down. When I go on my walk every morning with my dog, like, I go through, like, what's happened, what I've got to deal with and all that kind of stuff, any issues I've had, all past traumas, so that I don't turn to something like that. But, yeah, it's so hard. And as I was saying back to what we were talking about with things like Cullen Park, they really helped, because I was dealing with people that were really struggling at the time. If they'd have been able to stay somewhere and get better than that, it's like recovering from an injury. You know, it's like, okay, someone breaks their leg in a footy game. Okay, you put it back together, throw them back on the pitch the next week. That it's going to break again straight away. That's the same thing as someone's mind. It's going to break again straight away when that's got those outside stresses put on them. Let them recover. Like, you know, someone breaks their leg in a football game, they're going to have 6 to 12 months of recovery, proper treatment, all that kind of stuff. So the next time they get on the field, boom, it's fine. That they get hit with that pressure, it's fine. Same thing with someone's mind. You know, if they did the same thing, let that person heal, that person wouldn't end up back in the mental health unit again. Or that person wouldn't end up back in prison again. Or, as I said, some of them, they wouldn't end up suiciding.
I just feel the government should be giving, like, you know, you've got the in the health system, obviously a lot of people can't afford to get proper, unless you're at a private health fund or something like that. And the public system is pretty basic. I'd like the government to be able to grant, say, everyone at least 20 visits to a psychologist. 20 visits.
At least, yeah, that kind of thing.
On Medicare. That would be a great help.
And it would save in the long... But people look at this short term and say, oh, but that's costing this much. But the amount it saves in the long run...
Or someone is up in jail or...
Exactly, like the price of... The amount of money it costs to keep someone locked up is quite high. And as I said, if you gave someone 6 months in a Cullen Park type environment, somewhere they could recover properly from their mental health issues, you know, things like that wouldn't be needed. Like, that, I worked a lot with community corrections in my former role, by guys that had just got out of prison. They may have substance abuse issues. I'd make sure we're there straight away, but go to drug and alcohol, go see the doctors. They may have to get on Suboxone or Methadone or whatever it takes to help them, you know, become a, like, help break their addictions. Then help them, okay, we've got to get you on Centrelink first. So you're going to have some money. Here's how we're going to pay your bills, all this kind of stuff. Because people don't know that. And when they've suddenly it's all thrown in them, they're not in a good headspace, the amount of stress that causes, what's the first thing they're going to do is use. Are they going to use drugs or go and offend so they can get put back in prison again because they can't handle all this pressure? So being able to help them through it, where, as I said, if a place like Cullen Park was operating, they'd learn all this stuff, learn all these skills in there, so when they come out, they're ready to handle.
Yeah, so some people turn to drugs. I know myself, when I was going through a tough period, I tried DMT.
Yep.
It's a pretty complex sort of, I wouldn't call it a recreational drug, because it's not something that you're looking forward to having.
Yeah.
I just had it as, someone said to me, it's life-changing, and if you get through it, you'll fear nothing. You won't fear death.
Yeah.
And it's certainly right.
Yeah.
And what I got out of it was that you feel like you actually died when you have it. And it lasts for 20 minutes, but it's intense. And you actually think, and you're like, oh, no, what have I done? Tried this once and I've died. And then when you come back, you're relieved. It's a sense of relief. And you think to yourself, if I can survive this, I can survive anything. It just makes you one hell of a resilient bastard. You know what I mean? And so I don't regret taking that. Would I take it again? Fuck no.
Yeah.
Because it was scary. You know what I mean?
Whatever people take doesn't.
But it did. It sort of, it helped me become more resilient.
Yeah, if it's going to help, like for that one-off type thing, it's fantastic. Like I've had a similar experience when I had my car accident. I had an out-of-body experience that I can't explain, but you know, it affected me in a way that, you know, I don't fear death anymore in that, because I don't think anything happens after it, whatever. But it wasn't painful, but it was an out-of-body experience and something that, you know, probably similar to that type of thing where, yeah, it does make you appreciate every day, because you realise that, you know, how quickly things can be taken from.
And as I said, like, I look at you, and to me, you're a confident guy, you know what I mean? And I had a friend, I'm not going to mention his name, but, you know, like a lot of my friends know who I'm probably speaking about, who took his life. And he was one guy I went to school with. He was one of my best mates, like a groomsman. And when he died, it shocked me, because I thought to myself, this is a guy that I didn't look up. When I was a kid, I didn't have posters of people on the wall, Muhammad Ali's and things like that. Even though I admired them, I admired individuals, and it'd be hard for me to admire someone around my own age, but I actually admired this guy. He's my football captain. He was, what I liked about him, he was intelligent. He was tough. He was, but he had sensitivity too. So if he knew you were feeling down, but he was also a joker. He just ticked all the boxes, you know what I mean? And years later, you know, like he's had a family and that, and marriage broke down, and from whatever, I don't, you know, can't blame anyone. That's sometimes these things just happen. And you know, years later, he couldn't handle it, and bang. And then I find out that he's dead, you know. He took his life. And it was a shock to my system. This is a guy that I looked up to, a guy that everyone admired. He played a couple of first-grade football games. He was good at everything. Yeah. Good-looking guy, good style of a guy.
Unfortunately, a lot of people that we don't know about are wearing a mask. Mm. You know, if you know what I mean. Like, they're putting on this front that everything's fine. You don't want people knowing about your issues and stuff. Where you're, like, I've worn a mask before myself, especially towards my kids or, you know, out in life, where especially when I've had bad times. Like, I've come out and, you know, you wouldn't know, yeah, he's doing great, this, that. I'm going home and I'm crying my eyes out to get to bed, you know, and and at times, like, if it wasn't for my kids and all and my family, like, you know, I can understand why people mightn't want to be here anymore, you know. Yeah. I've had those stages, you know, it does happen, and those thoughts come across your mind. And, you know, I went through a tough patch, as I said, after, you know, wrongly being arrested for this thing. It was really hard because everyone seen things in the paper or what happened, and it's, you know, everyone says, oh, I didn't do it, yeah, right, whatever, but, you know, I hadn't done it. But it was a very hard thing, and to get through that stage was really hard. And, you know, couldn't work at the time, couldn't do anything.
My
because
advice there is, Dave, I mean, I had a similar thing in the police force when people are always going to think what they're going to think anyway. Yeah. Without the coppers, everyone's going, oh, why did he leave the police? What happened? And yeah, everyone was whispering and all that sort of thing. End of the day, those people that are talking and all that, unless they're family, unless they're close friends, who gives a fuck what they think?
Yeah, exactly. To be honest with you. Exactly. But
you know the truth.
That's something you've got to go through.
Yeah.
And it is hard.
You get that through. As you get older, when you're young, you worry about that, what people think.
Yeah.
You get older, you get to a stage, I know I'm 54 now, you don't give a fuck, because you think to yourself, mate, who the fuck are they?
Yeah, but that's how I feel now about that kind of thing. You know, it's you know, people. I know the people that were there all the way through. Like, and I'll see you now, Greeny and Chalk and that. We're all the way through with things. You know, they'll
certainly
always
find out who your friends are.
Exactly, and you also know the real truth behind people. As I said, that guy that we had the issue with in the amateur boxing. You know, he was the one that, you know, would be writing me off and own jealousies and stuff like that. And you realise people like that are just so pathetic, and, you know, they're not worth your time anymore. Yeah.
So, perfect segue now into someone struggling with mental illness, right? What's your advice?
Talk. as they say, it ain't weak to speak. You know, you've got to get there, speak to someone. That go see a counsellor. I've seen counsellors in that before. I've seen elders as well. Like, you know, and I know that it's so important. While you mightn't have that, you're not going to feel great straight away. It is important to get out there and talk about what's happening. Find the right help. That if they can guide you, okay, you've got to go and, you know, if you've got to go to the mental health unit, if you've got to be scheduled to go in, that's what you need to do. But at least go speak to someone, speak to a counsellor, speak to your doctor, speak to your friends, you know, family that you can really trust. You've got to talk.
Yeah.
You don't talk and you bottle it up inside, your head starts playing games with you. You know, that little man inside starts talking shit. Mm. Unfortunately, it does. You know, I don't care how hard and tough you might think you are. That little man inside starts sowing doubts. That, fuck, well, you know, I'm this, I'm that, I'm, you know, I don't want to be here anymore. You know, everyone's better off without me. And that's the way that people genuinely feel when they're, you know, when they do, when they want to suicide, you know, and that's a really horrible thing. And like, you think, well, everyone loved this person. Like, didn't they realize how much they loved? They didn't, you know, and
they couldn't find happiness. I mean, yeah. How would you define happiness?
Me?
Good question for you.
It is a very good question. Okay. There's things that make me happy. Yeah, my true, I feel happy just knowing, like, when I get up in the morning. Looking at the sunrise, I get up early every morning to walk my dog and stuff. The true happiness comes from my family, my kids.
I agree.
Seeing my kids happy.
Yep.
No matter what they're doing, like one of my sons is now going to be one of the youngest captains on the harbour in the ferries. Wow. You know, like he's 19, Dakota, he's like, he's a big boy. He's like, so proud of him, you know. He could read tide charts and moon charts before he could read. He's loved fishing and water and everything on the boats all his life. You know, seeing him happy, you know, is so good. He's, you know, he doesn't live at home anymore. He lives with his girlfriend and that. He has his fish tanks, breeds all his fish and stuff. But, you know, I love seeing him succeed. Seeing him happy is so good. Seeing my younger boy, Callum, happy with his soccer and, you know, he's a young man now. He's in high school and stuff. So he's
developing. Probably why we get along, mate, because to be honest with you, what makes me happy is the same thing. If my kids are happy, I'm happy. If my wife's happy, I'm happy. You know what I mean? And that's what it comes down to. Because, you know, as they say, happy wife, happy life.
Yeah.
You've got happy children.
Yeah.
Mate, you're over the moon with everything in life. And then you're able to sleep at night. You're able to get into a good routine yourself of exercise, work. And, you know, it's an old cliche people say, oh, money's not everything, right? Well, it's true. It isn't everything because you can have all the money in the world
gonna save
and be the most miserable prick on the planet if you haven't got a good family life.
Yeah, unfortunately, I've met a lot of people like that. You know, money does help, but it's not going to make you happy.
Yeah.
You know, I've had a bit of money before. I've had no money before, and, you know, I've been just happy with nothing, you know. But, yeah, I've also got hussies like – he's like my adopted son and that. Yeah. He's 38 now. I've had him since he's 14, you know. He's fought for me and all this. Like, I treat him like my son. When I see him upset, that kills me, you know.
Yeah.
He's gone through a lot of issues and over time, but he's like, he's manned up. He's being a really, like, at the moment, seeing him being a good father and all that kind of stuff to his own son is, like, tremendous, you know. They're the things that, you know, do make you happy.
And even though he's not a blood son, you still love him. I got an Aboriginal kid that lived with me for a couple of years. Travis, if he's listening out there, who he lived with us and he was coming down. He played rugby league for the Roosters. And, I got an affectionate with him because, I mean, you live with someone for 2 years and you share, you know, breakfasts and dinners and things like that. And he's captaining his football team in up in Newcastle now. The guy had that much talent. It's unbelievable. He was like, he played in that same Roosters SG ball team as Latrell Mitchell,
right.
Manu and all those guys. Wasn't meant to be, you know, big smoke. He got caught in the big smoke and he's like, oh, you know. And he went back up to the country and he's captaining up there. He's killing up there. Last time I spoke, he was quite happy. So call out to Travis Edwards.
The thing, the old saying, like, blood makes you related.
Yeah.
Loyalty makes you
family. That's right.
and you know the people that are there for you. And that, like, Huss has always been there for me and my boys at any time. Like, obviously my boys are there for him. They love him like their big brother.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, and I love him like a son.
Yeah.
And to be able to say that when you know that you've got sons, that's when you know that.
Man. There's something different now. I'm going to name 10 different people here. We're going to have a bit of fun. Right? You've spent a lot of time with all these people.
It's hard to find fun.
And I want you to just give me one word to describe these people, right? Here we go. First one, Danny Green.
Brother.
Anthony Mundine.
Goat.
Hussein Brothers.
And brothers, you know, yeah.
Jeff Fenwick.
Absolute legend, you know. Again, he'd be...
One word.
Well, if you already used goat, okay, goat again, because he is the greatest of all time with our boxers.
Nader Hamden.
And brother, you know, yeah.
Costa Zoo.
Legend.
Jeff Harding.
Absolute, oh, sorry, freak.
I'll say tough on that one.
Tough, yeah, but freak. He was beyond tough. You know, beyond tough, beyond determined, like... Yeah, he was like a freak, but in the best way possible. Like, I love him. He helped me with so much in my career. But, you know, he liked to drink, okay? And up until 6 weeks out before a fight, he'd be drinking. But, we'd go running. We'd run Coogee to Bondi and back sometimes. And we'd go running, or else we'd be doing the track. And you'd be going all right, and then suddenly you'd be vomit everywhere. Worst thing is he's going to go 10 times harder after that. Like, you know, he pushed himself beyond.
And he also won the light heavyweight title against Dennis Andres.
Twice.
Yeah, and it was like a real-life Rocky movie. He was getting hammered, and he come back and won.
Yeah. Nearly every one of his fights.
Doesn't get the recognition he deserves, you know.
No.
And that was a WBC title when there was a lot of good light heavyweights around. Now, this one's Smokey. Paul Gallen. Being a Sutherland man.
That's one I put tough. Yeah, tough. You know, I was lucky to work with him in the Sharks. That's I worked with the Sharks for a long time in their strength conditioning.
Well, I'm going to put two words in here, fucking extra tough. No, three words, fucking extra tough.
Yeah, definitely. But as a boxer too, you got to remember, at first he was a footy player boxing. But then he became a boxer who used to play footy. You know, he earned his stripes. He did really well, but, you know, he's a good man. I've always gotten along well with him.
Family man, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, he improved. He really, I'm glad he went to Graham Shaw, learned how to box properly, and, you know, they really made his career. And I'm glad the Rose Boys made a lot of money with him. You know, they deserved it.
Now, I ask this to every guest that comes in. If there was one thing you had to change about yourself, what would it be?
You can't
think about the question.
Yeah, if there's one thing I would change about myself, that is a hard one because, you know, I am how I am because of how I am. You know, for all my faults and good things, you know, I wouldn't be me without it. Yeah, I should be better at certain things, but I'm trying to be better. And this is the thing. That's what I was saying before. Every day I go out and I have addressed all my traumas and that before. And I try to make myself that 1% better every day. So that every part of me I want to improve, but there's nothing I would absolutely change. You know, I'm making incremental changes every day, trying to be that 1% better person every day. Because, to try and make a sudden change is very difficult. Like, I've tried to get rid of all my bad aspects of my life. Like, I've done my best to make sure I don't drink anymore. You know, I don't do silly things. I don't mix with the wrong people. I make sure, you know, I make good decisions in life. I think about things, you know. Now where before, you know, do something or, let's have a drink. I don't do that anymore. So it's I wouldn't change things and I can't change the past. Mm-hmm. I make those subtle changes every day.
Subtle changes.
Yeah.
So that means Dave can change, which means I can change, which means you can change, which means we can all change. So until next time, I always say, treat people as you like to be treated yourself. Don't take any shit from anybody. Till next time, guys, girls, Catch you later.